Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello and welcome to the War Room podcast. I'm Andrew Hill, the Chair of Strategic Leadership at the U.S. Army War College and the War Room Senior Editor. The War Room is happy to bring you a series of podcasts on strategic and senior leadership in conjunction with the U.S. Army Strategy Conference and the Strategic Studies Institute. This year's conference examined the theme of strategic leadership in 2030. It asked panelists, students, and guests to examine the current and future requirements for senior and strategic leadership. Today, I'm pleased to have Dr. Pauline Shanks-Corn with us. She is a philosopher who specializes in military ethics, just war theory, the philosophy of law, and applied ethics. She is the author of Achilles Goes Asymmetrical, an awesome title of a book, published in 2014, and is currently working on a book about obedience in the military context. Currently, she's an associate professor and chair of philosophy at Pacific Lutheran University, but in July, she'll be joining the faculty of the Naval War College. So welcome to the professional military education community.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, Pauline, for joining us today in the War Room podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start out with a question about military ethics. Why should we care about this? Why is this important?
I think it's important because it's a matter of life and death. Our ethical frameworks around war and around, in particular, killing and maiming in war literally mean the difference between some people living and some people dying. And also, I think in the news recently, there's been much more conversation about the phenomenon of moral injury, which is sort of what happens to people after they've been in war, and the consequences of what we ask military members to do for their own lives. We ask them to do things on our behalf and in our name, but very often those things we ask them to do take a toll on them spiritually, religiously, and morally. And so I think since they're doing these things in our name, it's really incumbent on us, especially as civilians, to think about what are the ethical reasons and limitations around which we're going to think about war and warfare.
So just to play devil's advocate a little bit, if you look at the history of warfare, ethics sometimes seem to be a consideration that is a luxury that we afford ourselves when we're in a position of relative advantage. So we follow the rules that we set for ourselves, which are built in an ethical framework. But when we're under duress, we seem to readily abandon those. So an example maybe would be the bombing of civilian targets in the Second World War, the atomic bomb, or unrestricted submarine warfare. How do you respond to that? That ethics are, military ethics are just a luxury?
I mean, I understand that perspective. I just disagree because I think in the long term, I think that there may be things that you can do that are unethical that get you short-term strategic advantage. But I think in the long term, having an ethical framework and doing as much as you can to adhere to it is really important for long-term strategic viability and also for the long-term mental and religious and spiritual health of a nation. I think there have been times and there will be times when we do things that are unethical because we feel like we have no other choice, or that if we didn't, it would be what Michael Walzer calls a supreme emergency, like the future of our political state would be in peril. I think those times are relatively rare. So I think we need to be really honest about sometimes we say, well, we have to do this. And it's not really that we have to do this. We're choosing to do it. But I think the other function that ethics can have is to tell us what to be shocked about. And so sometimes, yes, we do unethical things, and part of the ethics discourse is afterwards to repent and to say that was the wrong thing that we did, perhaps, and to learn from that. And anyone who has or raises children knows this, right? Your children don't always do the right thing, but to say you shouldn't have ethical standards for your children because sometimes they're going to fall short of them seems odd, mm-hmm. right? Because we hope that they learn from the standards, and when they fail to live up to them, then they'll learn from that process and hopefully not fail in the same way again. So I also tend to think of ethics not as perfection, ethics as you are growing to be virtuous over time, and it's a process both for people and for nations. It's an aspiration, and being an ethical person doesn't mean that you never do anything wrong. And I think that's a mistake in American culture. I think we have a perfectionistic view of ethics, and so sometimes people want to say, well, you know, people break the rules of war all the time in war, so why should we have rules? And but we have laws against murder, even though people commit murder. But part of the function of those laws is to say to some people, we don't want you to do that, and to say to the people who do that, we're going to punish you, right?
War seems to have a tendency to erode some people's ethical sensitivities.
Yeah.
You know, the longer the war, the costlier the war, the harder it is to get people to adhere to some of these basic principles. So you're going to be joining the Naval War College. It's responsible for educating senior military officers. The Army War College does that. How do you help officers avoid, or military leaders more broadly, avoid that erosion in conflict?
That's a great question. I think it's really difficult. I think I'm a big fan of the Stoics, and the Stoics believe in something called rehearsal, which is that you think about things before they happen, and maybe in military terminology, we run scenarios, we do drills, we do practices. I think you need to do moral drill practice too. You need to think about and practice what kinds of situations you're going to be in, and what are the moral dangers that are involved? What are the moral pitfalls that you might encounter? And think about those things before you go in. What are the ways in which we know from literature and movies, we know what that moral erosion looks like. And so I think there are lots of ways to rehearse before you go. Or for the more senior officers who have been there, to then process when you come back and say what happened, and have a deconstruction or an AAR, as you all would say in the military, about what happened and what went well but what didn't go well. And I think very often ethics tend to erode in war because there's a lot of rationalization going on. There's a lot of, well, I don't have a choice. I have to do this. I have to protect my people. Or acting under pressure and duress because you don't know what to do, emotion. And that, I think a lot of that is because you haven't perhaps anticipated or been confronted with the particular issues that you're faced with. But I think a lot of issues, moral issues in war, I don't think there are a lot of new moral issues in war. So I think a lot of things can be rehearsed. And I teach Army cadets at PLU, and I spend a lot of time with them asking them, okay, what do you think is going to happen in this kind of scenario, and how are you going to think about it when you get there? So that when they're in that situation, maybe they don't have a full-blown plan, but they've at least encountered that this is a possibility. It's sort of like getting in a car and never thinking about what you're going to do if you're in a car accident.
Yeah, there's a great, so you're going to be taking the Stockdale chair.
Yes.
At the Naval War College, and Admiral Stockdale is an outstanding example of someone who lived the Stoic philosophy. In one of his lectures on Stoicism, he talks about being in his parachute after ejecting from the aircraft. And he's looking down at the ground, and he sees all these angry people waiting for him. And he's starting to rehearse in his mind what is going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fascinating and really powerful example of what you were just talking about with the Stoics idea. I'm a huge fan of the Stoics as well, of how they sort of encourage you to, all right, what are you afraid of losing in your life, right?
Yeah.
And how will you respond to that? What are the things that make you fear kind of losing control in your life?
And I'm actually going to, spoiler alert, I'm going to talk about Stockdale, that exact example, tomorrow, only I'm not going to tell them I'm talking about Stockdale. So I'm going to use that to think about what does strategic leadership in extremis look like. And you're exactly right. He's rehearsing what he's going to do and what is about to happen. But also he spent time studying philosophy and studying the Stoics, and he credits Epictetus with saving his life, which most people think of philosophy as something incredibly impractical and not useful at all.
Yeah.
And
so I think philosophers are largely responsible.
A philosopher, I would agree with that, but I think it's a great way to say that there are these tools that you could hone, before you get in these situations. And that situation is a great one because he literally only has moments as he's sort of floating down and he's thinking about what is about to happen to him. And he doesn't have a lot of time to get things together and to get his thoughts together and to figure out what's in his control and what's not in his control.
Let's shift gears and talk a little bit now about the future of warfare and military ethics. If you think about war 20 years from now, and I know that's a tough setup because honestly, the professionals right now, I think, have a really hard time thinking about war 20 years from now, but just sort of setting that up, war 20 years from now, what are the major ethical challenges of that time? Or maybe to put a finer point on it, to what extent are they different from the ethical challenges of war today? What do you see emerging that is creating new challenges for leaders?
That's a hard question because I tend to be skeptical about, I mean, I think technology in war changes. So the particular kinds of technology that we have now will have different technology in 20 years. And maybe we'll have autonomous, you know, war fighters. We may have, you know, human enhancement. We may have AI. But I think that the ethical challenges that are posed are going to be largely the same ones we have now. I think one thing that will increase, I think the amount of information that is on the battlefield will either be astronomically, you know, more than it is now, or we'll have no information on the battlefield. But I do think the issue of time pressure is only going to increase as the decision cycle, as technology changes and is able to be faster. It seems like that people will be under more and more time pressure to make quick decisions. So I imagine that's a problem in combat and warfare now, but I imagine it will, you know, just looking at the last 20 years, I think that will continue to increase. I think relative competition around technology will be an issue. So do you, you know, thinking about what technology we have versus what technology our adversaries have and how that is going to limit or change our ethical choices. So if we're at a technological disadvantage, then are we going to be willing to make moral compromises because now we're at a strategic disadvantage relative to technology or some other kind of consideration? I think we may have more machines involved in war, which will sort of necessitate us thinking about what aspects of war do we think of are truly human and should be done by human beings. And what aspects of war perhaps could be outsourced, to use a business term, to machines. But then what are the implications of that for who's responsible for what those, if those machines commit a war crime, for example, right? Who's accountable for that? I also do wonder what the civilian military context will be in 20 years. The last 20 years, it seems civilians have become increasingly distant and deferential to the military in terms of asking the military to make judgments about whether war is worth doing or not. Increasingly, I see this with my undergraduate students. They're increasingly resistant to making any of those judgments, especially moral judgments. They say we should leave that to the military to decide. And as the military ethicist, I want to strongly say to them, no, that's not the military's job. That's our job as civilians who control the military to make those decisions. But I think that may impact, because if you don't have civilian support or even any kind of engagement, then what does the military become? Does it become mm-hmm. sort of a kill for hire operation, or does it just become, we expect you to keep us safe and we don't want to know anything about it or being engaged in that process at all?
Yeah, well, and that's one, I mean, one concern that is expressed regarding the increased sort of automation of war,
right?
Which is that as risk to humans on our side declines, the ease with which civilians can call on the military to create violence increases. They become more willing because we've got less in the game, less at stake, and so that military easy button just gets bigger and bigger. From a moral standpoint or an ethical standpoint, I know they're not the same, but do you think that the increased distance from violence is going to create, let's assume that that continues, right?
Where
the sort of distance between the warfighter and the effects of his or her decisions continues to kind of increase. Are there some ethical concerns that arise from that, or do you sort of think that's overblown?
No, I don't think it's overblown, because, I mean, we know from studies that as that distance increases, then it increases the likelihood of violence, particularly indiscriminate violence, because there are fewer consequences, or it's harder to see what the consequences and the impacts are. I mean, I guess one question is, there's more distance, but if we think about UAV operators, drone operators, they're distant from the battlefield, but they can also see the battlefield in much higher resolution than we would conventionally think of someone so far away. And so we also have to think about, what does distance mean? Are we talking about physical distance? Because I can have physical distance from my children, but then I can also FaceTime mm-hmm. them, and I can see their face really clearly, and I can feel their emotions, and there is a kind of connection even though there's physical distance. So I think we have to think about, is it physical distance on the battlefield? Is it that physical distance, but you have video links, you can see like your adversary's face while you're killing, in the process of killing them, and that would be a very different kind of thing. So I think it'd be really interesting to think about what kinds of distance the future battlefield gives us. And it may give us some kinds of distance and erase other kinds of distance, which would have some, especially if, I mean, imagine if you could see your adversary's face close up while you're killing them. That would have certain kinds of effects that are different than pushing a button and seeing an explosion mm-hmm. from far away, and you don't know if they lived or died, and you don't necessarily, it's not the same kind of human connection. So I think that will be interesting, because I think technology can both separate us, but then it can also at least make it feel like we're closer. I feel like I'm there with my children, even though I'm really not. So I wonder how technology will actually cut both ways.
And there's a lot of uncertainty around that, because we don't know if we'll still have human operators,
right?
In those drones 20 years from now. Certainly, by policy, right now we will, but
yes.
Who knows if that will endure? So to conclude, let me just ask you for a kind of reading recommendation. Is there anything that you've read recently that doesn't have to be that recent either? You know, you can sort of think in the last decade. Anything that you've read recently that you would recommend to our audience, and why?
Well, I'm working on a book, as you said, on obedience right now. So most of my reading has been around that. But Elizabeth Samet, who I think she still teaches up at West Point, she wrote a book called Willing Obedience. And it's about military, but also civil obedience, mostly in the 19th century. And it's the reason why I like the book is it's a weaving of literature and history. She talks about Sherman, but she also talks about Thoreau and Moby Dick. And so it's this interesting weaving of, you know, 19th century literature and philosophy and war history around the question of obedience and whether whether obedience should be sort of uncritical, what we might think of as slavish obedience, or if there's a different kind of obedience that we need to have as citizens in a democratic republic. And so that I like that book just because it's an interesting mixture of different kinds of genres. And so I think it's the kind of book that I would have read even if I weren't writing a book on obedience. But I think, that book definitely is one that that I think is really interesting.
Well, Dr. Pauline Shanks-Corin, thank you so much for joining us here in the War Room Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We really appreciate you taking the time, and thank you for listening. We hope you'll join us next time.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.